Hello, everyone, and welcome to What Is This Music? A podcast about the mysteries of musical taste, why we love the music we love, and hate what we hate, and what it all means, and why it matters. Further to that, why do we care about what kind of music other people like? Why do we care what people think about the music we like? And why would we pretend to like something we don't, or that we don't like something we do? I'm not sure, but these questions preoccupy this project, and they come up a lot in a book I read this year, one of my favorite books of the year. It's called Don't Call It Hair Metal by Sean Kelly, out from ECW Press in 2023. And he talks about, regular listeners know, I love talking to people who are experts and fans of a type of music that is really unpopular with everyone else. And hair metal definitely fits the bill. Sean talks about the genre with great enthusiasm in the book and in our conversation. I'll let you hear it as we get into it. Enjoy. Sean Kelly, welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be here with you, Malcolm.
Yeah. So, I mean, you're the author of Don't Call It Hair Metal, Art in the Excess of 80s Rock, one of my favorite books of 2023. Congratulations.
Oh, thank you so much. That's very kind of you.
So let me start by just asking to clarify for those of our listeners who might not be completely familiar with, subgenre classifications, what is hair metal? How would you define it?
Well, I mean, that's kind of the what I would call the pejorative term that was assigned to the commercial hard rock of the early to late 80s and into the early 90s.
Uh-huh. Yeah, well, that's very, I think that's very true. A very nice, succinct description. So why write a book about it? What was your inspiration there?
Well, I mean, that was my gateway drug to music, right? Like, it was my introduction to rock and roll, because it was the popular music of the time in my coming of age. I wrote the book because when the 90s came along, and bands like Nirvana and Pearl Jam and the whole Seattle movement came along, there was a big house cleaning that happened in the music industry. Mm-hmm. And because some of the sonic traits that went along with that type of music had become overdone, and the music really did become homogenized and over commercialized, a house cleaning kind of happened with the grunge movement, and that music really became a bit of a joke to a lot of people. And what I wanted to do when I wrote the book was I wanted to go back and kind of say that no, the best of this music deserves a place in the rock and roll lexicon. Like, I mean, it's important. The best of it is important. And we should go back and investigate what the elements are in hair metal, let's call it hair metal, that tie it to a greater lineage of rock and roll history. Mm-hmm. That's a long-winded way of saying I wanted to defend music that was important to me, and I wanted to make an argument for why this music matters.
Yeah. And you talked about the elements. What do you think those elements are?
Well, I think those elements were, starts with the drums. It's funny. I just finished watching a documentary on Little Mountain Sound, the studio in Vancouver, where so many of these albums were made. And really, it was about the drums, and all of a sudden drums taking up this massive sonic space, and then trying to find a way to make guitars and vocals compete with this massive new drum sound. So it was really everything bigger than everything else, everything louder than everything else. And it got so excessive that after a while, when everything's loud, does loud matter anymore? When everything's big, does big matter anymore? And really, bands like Nirvana and the whole Sub Pop scene offered a palate cleanse and kind of a return to those early rock and roll sounds of the 60s and 70s that really are just as exciting as what was happening in the 80s, right? So it's really, to me, those elements I'm talking about are the big elements, the ambience, the reverb, you know, the affected guitars.
Yeah. It's funny that you should say that you should contrast a big sound to Nirvana, because when I listen to the Nirvana Nevermind lately, it just sounds so huge and big produced. Like the drums are just, you know, epic.
Totally. It's funny, right? Because really, we're human beings. We like to compartmentalize things into easily digestible chunks of history, right? But history does not work like that in whether it's music or anything else. And really, they were trying to make a big rock record. And it was like those drums are big too. But I think the difference came in all of a sudden, it was probably Kurt's guitar tone palette, right? Mm-hmm. Where you're getting things that are a little, and also not just the sonic palette, the approach, right? Which was a simpler approach. So you're getting things that are a little, it wasn't about virtuosity per se. It was about simple things that sound incredible. When he played a guitar solo, he just played the melody of the song, you know, like what a great concept. And those solos are instantly memorable.
Yeah. Of course, you might say that Twisted Sisters, We're Not Going to Take It, did the same thing, but
I sure would, because it's the first guitar solo I ever learned.
So in the intro for the book, and just now, you talked about wanting to defend the genre. And I'm curious, in your opinion, why do people dismiss hair metal?
I think a lot of it has to do with lyrical content. I think a lot of it has to do with cultural zeitgeist. I mean, this music was happening as MTV was burgeoning, right? So all of a sudden, you are literally putting image sometimes before music, hair metal. Like for the first time, this becomes just as important, and in some cases more important. You know, you're spending more on a video budget than you did on the record. You know, so I think people just got tired of seeing the same thing, because it also dovetails with a change in the music industry, where all of a sudden independent record labels that were once formed by music lovers now are part of massive corporations that have to turn a profit for shareholders. So you're getting a sameness that's happening, because rather than music fans coming in, you've got bean counters coming in. So these accountants at record companies have just as much say, and they're going, well, a successful record has to have this producer, this clothing designer, this video director. We have the data. So right. You're getting the same. And in fact, sometimes you're getting the same session players. So you're actually getting the same people. It actually goes back to like bands like the 60s, like Paul Revere and the Raiders, where it's really just a bunch of session guys playing the same records. It's kind of funny. The more things change, the more they stay the same, I guess.
Sure. So, I mean, so you talked about some of the reasons why people might dismiss hair metal, but why do you care if they do?
Well, I care because it was the music that inspired me to be a musician. And I have found this, if I'm ever in a situation where I am contributing ideas, maybe in a songwriting situation or a recording situation, if I was to say, hey, check this out, this lick kind of has like a bit of a Whitesnake or a Cinderella vibe, that would in many cases be dismissed. Well, we don't want that. That's cheesy. But if I played the same thing and said, yeah, it's kind of got a bit of an Aerosmith vibe, all of a sudden that becomes more palatable. If I say, hey, it's got a bit of a Led Zeppelin vibe, that's even more palatable. So it bothered me that I couldn't authentically credit my inspirations in the same way and get the same result as if I said something that was quote unquote more cool or more hip. That bothered me because, you know, not only did I listen to this music, I read the liner notes and I investigated the people behind it. And in many of these cases, I've come to know the people behind it. And I know their artistic intention was every bit as true and valid as a Led Zeppelin or an Aerosmith or any number of bands, a T-Rex, a Sex Pistols, whatever could be considered hip, you know? Mm-hmm. So I think that's what it was, really. I wanted to defend the people. And ironically, when I went in and really did the research, sometimes it was indefensible. Sometimes the lyrical content was just too pure. It was too stupid. It was too sexist. It was too isolating. Like, I was like, oh man, this isn't as good as I remembered it. This didn't stand the test of time. But like all of us who are music listeners, I associated it with a place or a time or a coming of age moment, right? Like we all do when we listen to music when we're 14 through 16. It's just scientifically proven our brains just take that information in a different way and it forms us, right? So it was interesting. In a couple of cases, I had to kind of say, this isn't as good. And in other cases, I just fortified my stance.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I thought it was interesting in the book. You talk about you use the phrase duality of mind.
Yeah,
talk about some of the problematic lyrics, and I thought you threaded the needle quite ably there because you know in these times there's been a lot of occasion for you know people like us, like white middle-aged dudes, to kind of reflect on you know. I don't need to make the laundry list of all the things, but to reflect on your own behavior or things you might have done or said, but also to the culture you consumed, and you talk about problematic lyrics, but then you came to a place where you found this duality of mind. Can you talk about that a little more?
Yeah, well, I think I'm finding that in a lot of places, right? Like, I mean, where we're so polarized as a society right now, you find yourself sometimes like, do you have to make a choice between friends and family and your view of how the world should be shaped? You know, like, and I find it more important than ever to exercise that, to extract the good and to question the things that could be harmful to other people. Mm-hmm. So really, you know, that's what I'm trying to do. It's like, That's what I'm referring to with the duality of mind. It's like, wow, I love what this did. I love how this made me feel. I love that it employed people. I love that it inspired new art. I don't love that it marginalized some people. And to look back on that, you know, that's a thing. Marginalized people don't really care how you feel about your marginalizing of them. They just want to stop being marginalized, right?
Yeah.
So that's it, really. It admitting these things doesn't necessarily eradicate the good that came with it. It just hopefully makes things better down the road. And this is why, you know, when people talk about, oh, you're trying to erase history, it's like, no, you're not. You are actually delving deeper into history to make a better future. And that's what I feel we should be doing with this stuff. So on a lyrical content, I'm not willing to give up my Wasp records. I'm just not. I think there's too much good stuff. And it's so funny. I actually got to hang out with Chris Holmes from Wasp on a cruise. I just played a Monsters of Rock cruise with Lee Aaron. And for all of his reputation as this hedonistic, you know, you've probably seen the Decline of Western Civilization scene where he's pounding vodka in a pool, right? Mm-hmm. He's a sensitive, articulate, very knowledgeable musician and human being with a direct lineage to Eddie Van Halen. I mean, he lent Eddie Van Halen, you know, a guitar that he used on Women and Children First. Like this is incredible. So why would I throw away all of that wonderful stuff when we all acknowledge that Eddie Van Halen is a game changer? This guy plays a part in that. Like, I mean, just because he was involved with some things where even at the time, a guy like Blackie Lawless actually was a very intelligent guy. He called it theater of the mind, right? Like, so he said, I'm going to take things to this extreme, push all the boundaries so that people think about things. Now, we look back at that and say, well, yeah, you could have maybe done that without tying a naked woman to a rack. You know, like maybe that wasn't the best approach. And I bet you he'd say the same thing. I know he for a long time he wouldn't even play the song. How are you with profanity on this show?
Not a problem.
Okay, the song Animal Fuck Like a Beast. I mean, you know, he didn't play that for a long time because it didn't jive with his new beliefs or his recently reconciled Christian beliefs. But now he's come back and he's added that back in the set. I mean, we're fluid, right? Human beings are fluid in our conviction, and you should be because it should change with new information.
Yeah, for sure.
At least that's what I think, anyway.
No, I mean, I absolutely, I agree at any rate. You talk about some of the music being participatory, and I wondered if you could unpack that a little bit, but what you mean by that.
Yeah, well, I mean, that was kind of a thing I gleaned from an excellent book called Nothing But a Good Time by Richard Beanstalk and Tom Bossier. They were talking to Spencer Proffer, the producer of Quiet Riot, Come On, Feel the Noise, and Wasp and Kick-Ax. And he had this concept, it's of participatory rock that bands like Slade had already tapped into, Kiss had certainly tapped into it with the Kiss Army. This idea that the audience becomes just as important in the energy transaction and the creation of the art. So he knew that the Slade song, Come On, Feel the Noise, had the potential to tap into that. He just needed a band and a voice that could do that, right? So Twisted Sister tapped into that. They gleaned that from their work in the bars, right? In order to survive on the tri-state bar circuit, you know, where you're playing for bikers and gang members, and you know, you've got to get them on board and get them feeling part of it. That's really where that comes from, this idea that you create the unifying chant for the audience to also be able to participate. They really are essentially in live situation participating on a musical level, but you know, it's like the what did Kim Mitchell say and Pye Dubois and Rockland, Wonderland, close companions in the concert bowl. You know, we open our minds, we live the song. There you go. You know, like you're mind
Yeah.
melding in order to create something bigger than the artist and the audience.
Yeah. I love the detail you go into in describing the music. And at a few points, you talk about melodic guitar solos, and you even use the phrase melodic development at one point. And without going too deep in the weeds of, you know, music theory or anything like that, I was curious what you meant by that. I mean, obviously, you know, it's at some level it's self-evident what the term melodic means. But I mean, I guess what I mean is what does it mean to you when you talk about melodic solos or melodic development?
It's what I call the in and out in eight theory. You've got 8 bars in order to make an impactful musical statement that elevates a song. As a guitar player, I'm talking about guitar solos here, right? And I realized that there were certain people who were just masters of the form. Richie Sambora from Bon Jovi, Bruce Kulick from Kiss. Who else would be a good example? Steve Lukather from Toto certainly was a good example. Tim Pierce, the famous session guy who did the actual solo on Runaway for Bon Jovi before Richie was in the band. You know, these guys were able to create tension, excitement, form enough of a hook that related to the vocal somehow, and somehow create these fully developed little songs within a song. In an allotted 8 bars, or sometimes if it was, you know, a really hot guitar player like Steve Lynch from Autograph, they'd give him 16 bars because it was building and building and becoming more exciting. And that to me is what I'm talking about, the melodic development where it's you know, it's referencing the vocal enough that the audience knows that it's connected to the song. It's not something that's completely outside. And sometimes a great solo can be something completely disconnected. Eddie Van Halen was a master of it. He would just go someplace else. And it's like, I don't know what that has to do with anything other than it feels great and makes me happy and excited. But someone like Bon Jovi or Sambora, where a song's getting on the radio, you can sing. If I say Living on a Prayer, You can sing that solo play in your head. You know, it's in there. It's referencing what's already happened melodically in the song, but it's going someplace else with these kind of devices that have really gone back to, like, I don't know, Willie Dixon, Robert Johnson, Chuck Berry. You know, we do these idiomatic things as guitar players, where, you know, we kind of take the Keith Richards licks and the George Harrison licks and, you know, the Jimmy Page and the Jeff Becks and the Claptons. And we keep adding this kind of idiomatic vocabulary to newer developments, right? Eddie Van Halen comes along. He knew every Cream solo, every Eric Clapton solo, but now he's adding things he's picking up from his contemporaries in the Los Angeles area. You know, Randy Rhoads is coming out of Alice Cooper, but his mom, you know, owns a music studio, so, and is a classical music connoisseur, so he's got that element. He can blend those things. It's like, right, the little ball of aluminum foil that keeps growing. Sorry, I know that wasn't your question, but I made a new question for you.
Yeah, it's no problem. Digression is welcome. I love the enthusiasm that with which you talk about all of the bands that you love, and I particularly, I think we are maybe about the same age. I'm just about to turn 50 in a little bit, but
yeah, I got there a little bit ahead of you.
Yeah, I felt a little bit of kinship when you talked about how much you loved the Sammy Hagar era of Van Halen, or at least the first album, 5150, because I loved that. And I have nothing against David Lee Roth. You know, I love all that stuff too, but a lot of the kind of rockers who were a few years older than me, they did and still do really dismiss the Van Hagar era. What was it that you, I mean, sometimes I wonder, is it just because they, you know, they were attached to the Roth era, or conversely, is it just because I didn't have that attachment, so I could get excited about Sammy Hagar without having the baggage?
Yeah, you know, I'll speak for me. I had 1984 before I got 5150. I had it, but it was funny. I knew Van Halen was older or had been around longer than Rat and Motley Crue, so they felt like, it's like, yeah, this is a big hit. I see these videos. That's cool. But is it mine? And I realized I didn't maybe consciously know that then, but it wasn't mine. All of a sudden, Sammy Hagar comes along. There's a new Van Halen as I'm coming out of grade 8, going into grade 9. My dad has just purchased a used 50cc motorcycle. I've got a little bit of freedom happening in my life. I'm, you know, becoming aware of girls. I'm going up to my cottage where I can sneak a couple of beer with my friends. And, you know, I'm becoming free. I'm starting to understand what freedom looks like. And here's a summer soundtrack to that. So to me, I can't remove myself from that experience. It was also that summer that the 5150 tour took place. My brother-in-law gave me an option. He goes, hey, my brother-in-law lived in Toronto, my sister. Do you want to go and be in a salmon fishing tournament on Lake Ontario or go to a concert? Well, let me think about it. I'll go to the concert. And it was the 5150 tour at CNE Stadium. So all of that stuff, right? And remember, Van Halen didn't release any videos on the 5150 album.
Right.
So I didn't really know what it looked like. It was still a mystery. The only information I had a copy of Guitar World that talked about, you know, the sound reinforcement or something. So I'm just picturing it. I've built this thing up in my head. And then how many times in life do you build something up and it actually exceeds that, you know, what you thought it could be?
Yeah,
well, not often. And it did happen for me. So I'm feeling the power of Eddie Van Halen. And I'm hearing these songs, and they're my songs. This is my Van Halen, right?
Yeah.
So that's it. And I fully remember the Dave versus Van Halen And I was a Van, I was on the Dave side. I was on the Van Halen side, even though I loved Eat 'Em and Smile too. I loved it, loved it. But Van Halen was mine, so I had to back them up. So that's where I stood there. In retrospect, I go back and realize, oh, wait a second. Van Halen with David Lee Roth was like, you know, conquering Vikings, just, you know, destroying small villages. You know, it was massive. It was unbelievable. It was groundbreaking. It was freeform. It was jazz. It was Americana. It was, I don't know, everything, right? So the greater artistic contribution, I can't deny it's with Dave, to me, to my mind. But the emotional thing, it's 51-50. And for all of, you know, the complaints about that record being sterile or keyboard based, it's a down and dirty, raw, weird little rock and roll record with no click tracks and bizarre sonic choices because, you know, Alex is playing like, you know, electronic drums because there's no room in the little studio that Eddie has built to have a fully mic'd kit. Like, it's weird. And I love it. I love it.
Yeah. Well, the prejudice against keyboards, you touch a bit on that in your book, and I think that might be, you know, another digression that might or may not be fruitful, but I remember there being certain metal albums that would have in the liner notes no keyboards were used in on this record. It just,
yeah.
And I remember when I my punk band, when I would try to get gigs on the phone because there was no internet, and people would be like, what, you know, what instruments do you have? I'd say, oh, you know, we have a guitar, bass, and we have a keyboard. Keyboard. Like, it was this weird kind of macho prejudice against the keyboard that yeah. I could never figure out, and was always kind of bullshit because, you know, many, if not most of those bands would end up sneaking in a keyboard either live or on the records. And like, I don't know. It's just very odd. I feel like it has some kind of like, I don't know, there's some kind of weird, maybe like homophobic kind of element to it because it was associated with a sort of like fae synth pop or something. I don't know. Maybe that's unfair.
No, I don't think it's unfair. And I mean, ironically, you know, I interviewed John Webster, a great keyboard player from Vancouver in my book, and I've worked with John. Dr. Feelgood has tons of keyboards on it. It's all underneath the guitars. All those records did. They were all supported with subsonic keyboards. Uh-huh. So synthesizer, Poison, you name it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think I heard somewhere that Def Leppard's Hysteria has 7 tracks of keyboards on every song, but that may be apocryphal. I'm not sure. So let's get back on track. You're a musician. Your musical knowledge comes out a lot in the book. And you mentioned earlier playing with Lee Aaron, obviously one of the greats in, you know, 80s and beyond Canadian music. And if I'm not mistaken, you also mentioned that you played with Helix at some point.
I did. I did. And I, yeah, that was the first band, along with Honeymoon Suite, who I also played for a very short spell, subbing in for Derry. That was the first two bands I ever saw in concert. And I got to tour and write songs and record with both of them. So I feel pretty lucky about that.
That's amazing. And I mean, Helix, you know, I guess they're sort of in larger rock history, they're sort of a one hit wonder, but what a hit it was, you know, in the 80s, Rock You was so huge. But I have to ask you, you know, again, this is perhaps getting deep in another set of weeds, but have you read Brian Vollmer's autobiography?
Oh, I sure have. Yeah. Brian's one of my best friends. Okay. And yeah, I of course I have, and I've heard the stories firsthand. You know, it's wonderful. Brian remembers everything, and he keeps historical records of so much of that stuff. If you've ever been to his house, it's really like a museum of rock and roll.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah, I mean, the book is really really something for sure. Could have used a bit of a spell check, perhaps, but you know,
I'm going to tell you something. That's Brian Vollmer. It comes out in everything, and he makes it happen, and it's full steam ahead. And he'd be the first to probably admit it. He goes, "Yeah, sure," but he got it done. He wanted that out, and he wasn't going to wait around for people. He's going to make it happen. And you know, I've written many songs with Brian, recorded albums with him. You know, produce records with them. That's just the way he works. It's getting out there, you know. It's more about the content rather than worrying, hey, we could spend 3 hours on the snare drum. Well, fuck the snare drum. The song. Let's get the song out and done so we can make another song.
Yeah. Yeah, I respect that for sure. I mean, there's perhaps a happy medium to mm-hmm. be struck, but
for sure.
At any rate, I wanted to go back a little bit because one of the takeaways I had from the book was just, and it's a theme that's sort of throughout this project of mine, is like how people's musical taste is tied in to insecurity. And you talk about that in your book. There's a great quote where you say, you're sort of like digging in on, you know, why it bothers you if other people don't like your kind of music. And you say, quote, "When I face the pain of being ridiculed for listening to the music that was a shelter from other forms of ridicule in life, I am forced to confront my own insecurities." Yeah. I thought that was pretty deep, but I wondered, how do the insecurities fit in for you?
How do the insecurities fit in? Well,
I guess maybe that's to rephrase the question a bit.
Yeah.
Why do you think that people, I mean, I asked this earlier in a way, why do people dismiss hair metal and why do you care if they do? But to put it another way, why would it matter to someone if somebody likes another kind of music than they do?
Here's the thing. Yeah. You know what? While I'm on, sorry to interrupt you, but it just dawned on me. It's not that I'm all about subjectivity. I'm all about you and I don't like the same thing and we disagree, but we respect each other. But as soon as it gets pejorative, as soon as it gets, you know, slanderous or when you try to disvalidate something, I mean, if my identity is tied up in something, I love it so much that I've actually created identity around it, and you've dismissed everything point blank without delving into it the way I have, then I do feel disrespected, and it does hurt, because it's like you've just dismissed all this stuff when I've done the research and I know it's different. But Paul Gilbert from Mr. Big said something at the beginning of the book. He goes, you're talking about the narcissism of small differences.
Sure.
And I went, what? And I didn't know about this. It was a philosophy, a school of thought, you know, where basically, you know, we dive in so much on detail, whereas to other people, that detail just is irrelevant. Like they just, it makes no sense. It's like going to Mongolia and saying, hey, here's a Steve Vai record and here's a Paul Gilbert record. Can't you hear the difference? When they might not even, you know, they just hear loud electric guitar played fast, right?
Yeah.
So it really made me take a step back when I heard that and go, okay, why do I take this personally? You know, why should I? Maybe I shouldn't, you know? And I think that's human nature for anything we're passionate about, you know, because we tie up so much of our identity and our passions.
Yeah, absolutely. I did notice a friend of mine pointed out to me recently that a Numero group, which is a record label that has put out a lot of pretty hip, I could say, you know, compilations of international music through the years, has recently released a hair metal compilation, Bound for Hell on the Sunset Strip. So maybe the hipsters are coming around. I don't know.
Now that one though, I think that compilation, that's kind of the underground bands, right? It was more that Bound for Hell. I think it was part of a bigger, was that not part of a bigger kind of book project as well?
Could be.
I think so. You know, it's funny because even that to me, it's so funny. It came tainted with a bit of, well, here are the losers, right? Like here are the ones who didn't make it. And I was like, why did you have to go there? But it's not. It's absolutely not what it was about. But I'm just laughing more at myself there. You know, it's just about, here are the bands that were also there, but for some reason didn't connect on a mass commercial appeal, you know? And it's so funny because I love all types of music. I mean, I played with Nelly Furtado for 10 years. I played with Howie D from the Backstreet Boys. I did classical guitar records. Like I played on country records. I love music. And all of this stuff has brought me, the music of my youth just brought me to the world of music in general. I love punk. I love new wave. I love it all. I love good music that makes me feel something.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's funny.
Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just gonna say when I'm defending something, it's usually I'm not really on the attack. I'm more on the, I guess I'm always, when I'm arguing, I'm on the defensive, right? I more want to bring you in. And I think I said that at the beginning of the book. At first, I was gonna show you, I was gonna shove it up the ass of every hipster who ever, dismiss this. And I'm gonna dazzle you with science. Like, here's the music theory, here's the history, here's the connections. Haha, you didn't realize that. You didn't realize, Poison kind of sounds like Big Star, whatever the hell my weird theories were. But at the end of the day, that got so boring to me. I'm like, oh God, I'm boring myself. And I don't want to do that anyway. I just want to share why I love it and why maybe you might like it too if you gave it a chance.
It's
How
cool.
was it?
I liked in your book how you talked about discovering the replacements later in life and realizing that you wouldn't have been ready for it as a young kid. So maybe perhaps with the help of your book, some people could have the opposite realization about hair metal.
And isn't that's what it's all about? Shouldn't that be what everything's about? Shouldn't we be able to discuss things politically and to see another person's point of view and come to some kind of medium because we have a shared at least reality? Hey, we're both valid, but we just look at this differently.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, I agree 100%. Well, Sean, it's been great talking to you. We're running out of time, but I did have one more question that I wanted to ask, which is the question I ask to all my podcast guests, which is, you talk about different types of music in the book. You invoke classical, you even pop, you talk about a lot. You even drop in some references to hip hop. And you just talked about how you love all genres. Are there any genres that you can't get into no matter how hard you try, and if so, why?
No, I don't think so, because the older I get, the more open I seem to be getting, which is such a blessing. I see so many people go the other way, and I'm not doubling down on shit. I know nothing. Every day I realize how little I know about the world, and now I just want to be a sponge for everything. So yeah, I'm into music for the people. I'm into music for the friendship. So if I make friends with someone who's really passionate about polka, and I connect with them on some kind of personal level, I'm going to be a polka fan by the end of it. I guarantee you.
For sure. Yeah, I actually have one of my episodes is with a polka expert, so I hear you.
Amazing.
Well, Sean, thanks so much for your time. It's been great talking to you. I love the book, and I hope that people check it out. Is there anything else that you wanted to add or that you wanted to make sure we touched on?
No, you know what? Thanks so much, Malcolm. I really enjoyed chatting with you, and yeah, it thank you for being open to my flights of fancy and my many digressions. I digress a lot in my book too. I'm working on my new book. I'm hoping to digress less.
Oh yeah, what are you working on?
It's called Battle Axes, the Hard Rock and History of the Pointy Guitar.
Oh nice. Is that like Flying V?
Well, yeah, and all of the various permutations of Flying V's, Explorers, Moderns, and all things pointy. I think the pointy guitars are the hair metal of the vintage guitar world.
All right. Well, I look forward to checking that out. Thanks again, and all the best to you.
Thank you, Malcolm. Pleasure talking to you. All the best.
That's our show. Thank you very much for listening. I hope you enjoyed it. As you can tell, these episodes are few and far between these days as I work on the What Is This Music book, as well as other projects and just general life stuff. But they will pop up as I come across more things. I appreciate your listening. I hope that you are well, taking care of yourself, taking care of each other, and look forward to sharing more with you next time on another episode of What Is This Music?